I learned a lot about sound on that gig because you have to play part. Like the other thing is like drum parts and bass parts and to a certain extent, guitar parts on those gigs. You kind of have to know them.
Yeah. Like if the general idea is like C major to D major, yeah. It's not good enough just to strum it. You have to play it exactly the way it was played on the recording.
It's a lot, man. I always call prep for a gig like the buy-in. Like what's the buy-in?
I've never even been to LA, so I don't really know how the vibes are all that different, but I feel like the music you're writing is probably better suited for LA just from a real high level, at least what I'm thinking. Like when I think of New York, I feel like I think of like Village Vanguard and like Small's Jazz Club, because I have a really hard time in New York. Like the music that I'm writing and playing, I have a real tough time trying to find places to play in New York. People are always like, come to Florida.
Yeah, when I moved to New York, the path seemed pretty defined, at least for a while. I had just put out an album of my own stuff, and I had hired a bunch of musicians. Some of them were like friends of mine, and then there were a couple people who was like, I should get that person to do it because they'd be the right person. So
this is Coaxial?
It was the one before that. There was one called Mad Science. So That was kind of how my association and friendship, and I guess my musical relationship with Dave Fusinski started there, because I had him playing a couple tracks on my record, and then he started calling me for his stuff. So I was in Screaming Headless Torsos for like 4.5-5 years.
Wow, that long?
Yeah. Then I did a trio album with him called Keef Express.
Mm-hmm, I've heard it.
That was a trio that was kind of happening while the Torso stuff was happening. And then through him, I met Vernon Reed and a bunch of other musicians. And that's kind of what got the ball rolling for me in New York. You know, I kind of weathered a few things. You know, I feel like there's a few cycles people probably go through in that city. And I guess I was starting to feel like, I don't know if I'm going to be a lifer in this place, you know, but I still love it, man. I mean, the LA thing has been strange, and we can get into that also. Like I moved out here in 2017. Let's fast forward, because everything that kind of happened in between 2015, moving to Harlem and the end of it, it was great. Like I did some stuff I always wanted to do that I hadn't done. Like I got to try Broadway for a little bit, which was not my thing, but nice to like have that experience.
What show?
It was Kinky Boots. Mike Fisaglia was the bassist at the time. He was always on the lookout for like subs. I didn't love the experience, but I'm glad that I got to do it, because sometimes it's better to tick a box than just pretend like you knew what it was like.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, actually. Like we did a podcast. Ever Forthright is working on on our second record after 12 years or something. We did a podcast the other day with all of us on this thing together. And I had said, it's so great. Like, you know, I don't really play music for a living. I do it. So when I pick up the guitar, I pretty much only do what I want to do. And then Jared kind of challenged that. He's like, yeah, I guess, you know, I do play drums for a living. I do a whole bunch of stuff I don't want to do. But at the same time, I learn like a whole lot of things. I've been exposed to a lot more stuff. And I was like, oh, you know what? Yeah, you got a point there. And I would like to tick more boxes. But so how many shows a week did you do the Broadway thing?
It wasn't a lot. I did like 3 maybe total. They didn't love me. It took a lot of prep work. But it didn't really end well. But I didn't like it either. That's the thing. I'm not saying that out of sour grapes. It was just kind of like,
it's a mutual, this is not for, I'm not for you. You're not for me. See you later.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting what you're saying, like speaking to what Jared said and just the idea of like quote unquote doing stuff that you don't want to do. I think that's a dangerous path sometimes with musicians. And I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, when I moved out to LA, I didn't really have a plan. I just wanted to try something new, you know, and I didn't know if that meant I was going to be playing different types of music or doing more sessions.
Or weddings.
Well, you know, I did that a lot when I lived in Boston because, you know, I went to Berklee College of Music. That was the best way to make money up there. That gave me the most time to like do creative things during the week and like do other stuff. Cause like, I like the Cape and like Newport, Rhode Island. Those are like wedding towns. So,
yeah.
So you're always like, so it's a huge industry. And it was like, everyone I know played those. Like I played the, like, it wasn't like shitty musicians. It's like people doing big things, but like people doing like real shit, man. Like my friend, Jeff Basker, he's the most famous successful person I know. He's like this Grammy winning producer. Wow. And he does a lot of pop stuff. He was originally in Lettuce. He was doing a lot of that stuff, but you know, man, like jazz dudes too. And like fusion guys, like Steve Hunt, who played with Holdsworth, he was on a couple of those. And you wow. know, it's like everyone plays that stuff. Unless you don't want to play it and you've got another means to do it. But I think what I liked about it was, ironically, I learned a lot about sound on that gig. And like, just from like the standpoint of like, I'm a bass player for hire.
Probably at the weddings.
The weddings, because you have to play part. Like the other thing is like drum parts and bass parts, and to a certain extent, guitar parts on those gigs. You kind of have to know them. Like you can't rely mm-hmm. on a lead sheet.
Yeah. Like if the general idea is like C major to D major, yeah. it's not good enough just to strum it. You have to play it exactly the way it was played on the recording.
Yeah. It's a lot, man. And yeah. I always call prep for a gig like the buy-in. Like what's the buy-in? And it's a lot, man. And so, but at the time it was like, well, I can try to get a job at Newbury Comics, like, you know, working there, just working retail, or I can like play these wedding gigs and like make a few hundred bucks a gig and like kind of just work on the other shit that I want to work on, like my record and other stuff. You know, for a time that stuff was cool. There's that kind of stuff out here. I'm not really in that scene right now. I'm not really in any scene in LA right now, like, because 3 years into being out here, we all know what happened, like
fires and COVID.
That sort of upended a lot of stuff. And I had a very strange 2019 where like I had a touring experience that like made me start to rethink my life a little bit, because it went bad. And we're out in the middle of this tour, and like it was with Tony McAlpine. And
I was gonna guess. I remember that. And I remember Emil was on guitar and
Gergo was on drums.
When I was a kid, freaking Tony McAlpine was like, holy shit. I was like, yeah. I remember going on eBay and buying bootleg videos of his live shows and stuff. It was like, wow. I remember that thing coming in the mail. Someone just like went to a show of his and video. This is before YouTube, and recorded it, burnt it to a DVD, just wrote like Tony McAlpine live, wherever it was, like on the DVD. And like, would sell those on eBay. And when that came in the mail, me and my friend popped it in and we're like, oh my God, there he is. Like, that's a video of Tony McAlpine playing guitar.
Yeah, it's funny how that process is so fast now. You just type it in and it comes up. And
it's a little bit sad. I kind of missed it. But
like searching something out and trying to like hear what it is and discovering stuff.
Yeah, yeah. We talk about this a lot on here. Like the record store, the, you know, buying albums, buying music, physical things. Like I've not had really much success with like streaming. I don't know. It's just a different way to do things that like hasn't really been fruitful for me. It's been really tough. Like whenever Fourth Eye put out that CD in 2011, you know, I remember like our emails blowing up with people buying CDs and buying shirts and buying merch. And
right.
And now we've put out a couple, like I've put out a couple things since then. Ever Farther has, and I guess we're going to see how this goes in a couple of weeks when we do the next album. But I can't imagine it's going to be anything close to what it was in terms of like selling merchandise. I'm pretty sure it's going to be mostly, you know, Spotify streams, you know, that sort of stuff.
Was the first Ever Forthright record, was that on a label or was that like a self-produced, self-distributed thing?
Self. I mean, we said we had a label, but it was really just a guy in like a bedroom somewhere.
Got it.
But he didn't do anything except for like take some of our money.
So are we in the MySpace area? Or are we kind of like...
Yeah, I remember we paid a guy to do like the MySpace HTML and CSS, like deck it out, make it look all cool. Yeah, like I remember the MySpace had like a play counter. It'd say like, you know, 10,000 plays today. And, you know, and we were doing super, super well. But yeah, it was around then. And then we stopped. And I'm certain of that too, because when we were never good at social media to begin with. Mm-hmm. But we only opened up the Ever Forthright Instagram like a couple of years ago. And there's like, I don't know, 100 followers. We have like one post. So Instagram was even introduced after we had already kind of hung it up.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I put my first record out right as digital distribution became a thing where you could just put something on iTunes. That was like a controversial move at the time. It's weird, man. Like, just serendipity happened. And like, yeah. Like Bass Player Magazine did a review of my record, but also like I was on iTunes. So, also Coaxial Flutter came out in 2011. So I think the era of the paid download had a nice 7 or 8 year run. And then when Spotify started to become a thing, which I sort of clocked it in the States around 2012. But prior to that, I'm not going to say that I was like water skiing behind three yachts, but I was making money off my records. Fusion stuff or like, you know, anything like that, anything niche based. I feel like those particular people will pay for stuff. I think probably for metal also, maybe if not the records now, at least with merch, like people are buying stuff. But at that time anyway, I would get like monthly payouts, and they weren't, like I said, they weren't amazing, but they were consistent, and they were sometimes like $100. Sometimes it was like 50 yeah. bucks. Then I also sold physical. And I did that myself. I never had fulfillment. So it wasn't uncommon for me to like run an errand or something and have a backpack full of CDs and just go, I'd go to that post office, like kind of right below Union Square, and just like mail these things out. And then the international ones were a pain because it's like, you have to fill out the customs forms.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This alone is worth me like charging whatever it is to send it out. But in a weird way, man, like that stuff, it was doing something. Like, cause I get emails sometimes from people that kind of know that record, you know? So it's, I don't know, man. I think now with streaming, I think the thing that's tough about it is everyone's kind of using it. And I think there's probably some kind of long game to be played with it, but I think it's probably in conjunction with something else, you know? Like, I think the idea of funneling your audience to where you want people to go, I think there's a deliberate game to be played with Spotify, for example, which some people are benefiting from it, but I think it's never been more of like a Wild West thing for a lot of people, you know, because I think it seems like some people do really well on the streaming platforms, and maybe they even have the kind of deal where they're making some money from it. Like the label's not taking any money from it. Or if you're like an independent artist, I think you stand to make some money from it. The payouts we can say are pretty bad, right? But like what it actually yeah. does, I think there's probably some value in it, but I think a lot of it depends on like what people are expecting from it, you know? Someone benefiting from the download model where it's like, yeah, I could pay my cell phone bill this month just from the money I made from that, or like whatever. Like, they're going to be disappointed maybe if, because it's probably not going to yield the same kind of returns. Or it might.
There's Bandcamp too. That's like, Bandcamp is okay, go to my Bandcamp and pay for my music and you'll get you'll get like the download, you'll get the WAV files or whatever. But
yeah,
what do you even do with the WAV file these days? Do you drag and drop it into your iTunes library? Or no, you don't do anything.
Yeah.
Like, what's even the point? So like, even my Bandcamp, like I just put out this single this morning on Bandcamp 2 weeks ahead of time of when it's going to come out on Spotify and stuff. It's a simple like little jam,
right?
And but I was like, you know what, I like it. You know, we live in this world where you can just put out singles, and you know, so why not? But as I'm putting it on Bandcamp, I'm thinking to myself, what is anyone going to do with downloading this? It doesn't really make sense to download it. And like, what do you do? I have no idea. It's like an antiquated, it's sort of an antiquated thing. You might as well just like donate. It might as well just be a donation site.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Do you have a mailing list? Like, does Everforthright have a mailing list?
I think probably hiding somewhere that we don't know exists, like probably on our Bandcamp or something. Oh yeah, and do what with it?
Email those folks and tell them you got a new record coming out. From what I've heard, I can't totally say that like I've done a great job with this, because I let my email list go dormant, and then MailChimp, I think, thought I was never coming back and they deleted it.
Oh shit.
I don't like to talk about what I'm gonna do, because you know, but I am planning on like kind of redoing some kind of a mailing list. But like, you just end up capturing emails from, you know, email addresses from people who want to follow what you're doing. And then you can just kind of, you know, send out a newsletter or say, hey, we're doing this. you know, it's a good way to kind of communicate directly with fans. And I think some people like it because it cuts through the noise.
I hadn't thought of that. And I'm wondering, now I'm trying to think to myself, what would I do if I got an email from an artist that I follow on Bandcamp? Like, hey, Nick, it's Steve Jenkins. Just letting you know, I'm putting out my new album in a couple of weeks. I think that would catch my attention because it's more personable, but I also know you. So I wonder if, you know, if I don't know if I don't know, some random artist that I happen to follow, like, am I just going to skim through it and be like, all right, like unsubscribe. I don't want to get like more emails.
If I could just add my 2 cents, because I am the kind of person who will have my Bandcamp, and that's exclusively where I listen to music. Number one, I like the fact that I get to support the artists that I listen to. My Bandcamp library is not massive. I tend to listen to just like the same album over and over again for a while. So I am excited when an artist that I do like drops some music and I get the notification on Bandcamp. It's also a really great way for me to just have my library organized. But again, I don't use iTunes. It's the only thing I do use. I don't use Spotify either.
Interesting. So what would you do if you got an email from one of those folks, like more of a personalized email, like, hey, if you haven't seen, I dropped a new track.
That depends on how I feel about that artist and how the email comes off, right? If it's like, you know, Everforthright, for example, I'd be pumped. Granted, it's a little different because I do have a personal relationship with Everforthright, but it's one of those things where I haven't heard anything in a long time. I'm really excited about what's coming out that's new.
I got an email about your track today, so from Bandcamp.
Yeah, I didn't even know it did that until a friend of mine texted me a screenshot, and he's like, yo, this is sick. It's like, oh, shit. Yeah. Cool. I'm glad.
I'll tell you the other reason why I think a mailing list is smart, though, is because platforms come and go, but email has not seemed to waver in terms of its importance, even though, you know, you can argue, okay, on these platforms, people talk to each other and it's effective enough to swap information. But I think by and large, like having an email address is like one of those things people are still using it. So
that's a good assessment. That's true. That's really true. It's like simple enough where it hasn't really gone anywhere. You can't really get rid of email.
Yeah.
Maybe at a time it was used for more social things. Like, remember like chain letters, like forward this to 15 people, you know?
Yeah.
And then scroll all the way to the bottom.
Yeah. I'll tell you why I like it. Like if I got an email from like I think I'm on Krantz's. I think Krantz had a mailing list. I think a lot of people would put out things, and they wouldn't necessarily bombard your inbox, but it would be enough. Like, it'd be like, this is enough. Like, I guess my point in validating why I think these are good is because sometimes even if I go on Instagram, I'll miss something that's happening and I'll find out posthumously, like shit, man, I wanted to go to the show, didn't know what was happening. I was doing nothing last night and it was last night. And you're like, and you'll see like someone write their gig announced like, tonight we're playing, da da da. And it's like, oh, this was Tuesday. Like, I can't go to this. This already happened.
It's always too late, man.
Yeah. So I think like it's a way to cut through the noise. I don't want to say that I think social media is noise. I think it's been, I can say honestly, man, that's been a real valuable tool in a lot of ways, like just in terms of like keeping things moving, and like I've gotten work from social media. Like, so I can't knock it. I think I have a much more detached relationship with it than I once did. I like Instagram probably the best.
Well, I definitely don't think of you as a content creator. I don't think of you as I mean, there's content creators who straight up like will blast me with a new piece of content every single day.
Yeah.
And sometimes repurposing content, like it's a post that they put up 2 months ago, they're doing it again. I'm trying to find a happy balance between creating content, because I find that if I do it, it actually is good for me. Like, in terms of finding a new audience, it just is a shit ton of work, but I still haven't found the most lucrative avenue is yet. Like, is putting out music more frequently, is that the ticket? Is doing more content the ticket? Is doing more like podcast type stuff, or do people want to see more commentary type things, or do they just want to see me playing the guitar? I don't really know, because sometimes I put out a clip of a podcast that we do and it gets shared a whole bunch because it's like something funny and we're giggling and we're laughing and people share it and it's like a good time. Other times I put up a thing of me playing and it catches on for whatever reason. I think I'm playing just as good in it as I'm playing in something else, but yeah. This one gets, you know, 10,000 plays.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a crapshoot. I never know what's going to hit, but I'll tell you this much. My Spotify is garbage. I cannot get people to listen to my Spotify. I've got like anywhere between 60 and 75 monthly listeners on my Spotify, and I cannot find a way to funnel people to that platform. I just don't know how to do that. It's been like a real challenge for me.
I think my experience with Spotify right now is like I uploaded stuff on there after the fact. So I don't have any like new stuff to speak of that I've done. So I don't know what an album cycle would be like, or a release cycle would be like, using that as an actual thing. I know that like, by and large, the element of funneling is probably the thing that's going to help people go to like where stuff is found, I guess. But I don't know. See, in 2020 and 2021 and most of like, I guess half of 2022, I was doing a lot of content on Instagram, but Instagram was also paying people like Reels. They were really trying to sell the shit out of Reels. So I was making some decent loot. And when they stopped that, I was like, I'm going to wait a little bit. Cause I just got tired of doing stuff. But for me, a lot of those little content things were also, I was teaching myself things about production. So they were more fully realized. They weren't like, here's a bass thing, you know, here's bass thing number 4,072. Like it was just, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to make this guitar track I play sound like Nile Rodgers or something. Yeah. I don't know, man. Like I just would try to do something and, you know, it would be sort of bass forward, but it was definitely like, no, I'm trying to see if I can make a track that sounds like X, Y, Z, you know? Cause I was really, really, I still am very like into like production stuff. Cause I've kind of expanded some of the things I do. So I used it for that. Like I kind of use it as a way to like test some ideas. But I think whatever you choose to do, I mean, dude, if you play and you like post like more live clips, like the stuff I saw, like some of the recent ones, like, I don't know. I think people always love hearing good playing, but I think the rule of thumb that I've gathered from just watching people who I enjoy on social media, maybe my enjoyment has nothing to do with how successful, quote unquote, they are on social media, but the people whose content I like the best, it tends to be because they're just doing their thing. You know, it's not like they're really trying to fit into something. They're just kind of putting their thing out there. I think you can always like mold whatever that is to the standards of like whatever the format is, you know, like vertical video. Like it's not that hard to figure that out in terms of like, you know, you learn like keyframes. So if you want people to see the entire length of the neck, you can do like a quick little pan. But that's, you know, I taught myself how to do that by like going on YouTube and just learning about Final Cut Pro. Like there's a lot of little hacks like that, but it's not, I don't feel like it's, the format is never the problem. I think people get hung up on like, what do I show people? You know, and it's weird because you got people like, I don't really get reaction videos, but that's a thing, you know?
Yeah. That's sort of a mystery to me. I don't understand that either. But the format thing, it's definitely changing the way that I think about writing music. And it changes the way that I think about posting content, because when I post, I could post like a minute of me playing guitar. And if I know like, oh, at the 20-second point is where I really blast off. That's where I really start ripping. So right. I want like people to experience the buildup of me building up and getting to this point where I, you know, really start, you know, ripping at the 20-second mark. But then if I look at the analytics of that, it just goes like people didn't hang around for the 20 seconds to get to the point where I'm ripping. So right. That now I've started approaching posting stuff on Instagram, like just get right to the point where you're doing the ripping, like give it not even a second, like half a second, because people will make up their mind in a second or less whether they're going to swipe. Like, it really takes that quick for them to say, nope, next video.
Yeah.
So like, I'll cut it where it's not even a half a second before the thing happens, whether it's like a podcast thing where, you know, the punchline happens, or we're laughing, or it's a video of me doing like a lick on the guitar that's like the lick. Like, it's really got to be right up in the front. And then I was listening to some comedy podcast, and they got into when they do their stand-up specials for like Netflix and stuff. The old model was that they would save the bangers for like the end. You save your bangers for the end of the stand-up special. But now they're, at least from what I'm hearing from this particular podcast, is you put that stuff in the beginning because it helps with the retention. So you put your banging jokes right at the very front. You like almost don't even make an intro. And I've seen a couple examples of that too, where comedy specials on Netflix will, it jumps right to the guy telling a joke. It doesn't even do like the build up, the vibe, the do. It's like jokes.
Oh, and there's like no crowd work or
laugh. No, it's nothing. Yeah. It's not like him walking into, or her walking into like the venue down the stairs. Like, hey, how you doing? Like the coffee, like the back room. Like, I've seen a couple specials where it's just straight up like play. So I'm at the thing, blah, blah, blah. And just right at it, right into the stuff. And I thought that was really interesting. And that's like the opposite of how I used to write. Those Ever Forthright songs are like 7, 8, 9 minutes long. And they're often, you know, the build is often a big part of it. And I don't know who's sticking around to listen to that anymore. You know, the prog metal guys that are still around, or the ones that are just coming up and really kind of coming to the top, and you know, the ones that you hear about. It's a different kind of prog than it was 10 years ago. I feel like the songs are shorter. They cut right to the chase. It just seems like there isn't like the patience anymore for, like, I wonder if Stimpy Lockjaw came out now, what the vibe would be. Cause it's like, what the fuck? These guys like took 11, like, especially that one song on the album. Was it third, do I really not know the names of these songs anymore? it's been that long.
Yeah.
What's that? The last song.
Third Eye or something.
Third Eye. Yeah. That song is 9 minutes long. And I don't think the first like beat comes in until like a minute or so in the song. It's just like would anyone even listen to that nowadays? I don't know.
I think they would. I mean, I come from, you know, like a lot of the stuff that really freaked me out as a younger musician. And even I love it now. Like, my love for this stuff has never wavered, but like, you know, 2112 is a 20-minute song, man. Like the whole thing. If you listen to side one of Yes, Close to the Edge, like, I mean, you know, like, I marvel at those recordings, even though technically they weren't really from my generation. Like, I don't think I was alive when Close to the Edge came out. I was maybe just born when 2112 came out. Like, I think it's interesting when you hear bands that once wrote longer tunes, like how they pivoted to shorter material, you know. Like Rush is kind of an interesting example, because like their biggest records kind of came after they made shorter songs. Like, in shorter songs mean like 4 or 5 minute, 6 minute songs. Like, that's still not short by standards of that time period. But even like, let's, you know, everyone's favorite band. Well, I don't know. I love Metallica regardless of whatever they're doing now or whatever. Like, I've always had a love for, like, especially the first like five, like, I kind of dig the Black Record, Black Album. No one calls it the Black Record, the Black Album. I dig the Black Album in a way that like, I didn't really like it when it came out. Cause I was like, what is this, man? Like, we went from like 10 minute songs to like,
to pop tunes.
Yeah, to pop tunes. But I get it, because there's not a lot of bands that could pull that off, you know, like, and sort of like, it still retains enough of their thing where it still sounds like them. I mean, it doesn't have like Dyer's Eve or something like that, but I think that was a pretty successful thing that they did, you know, at least however many songs are on that record. Like I liked it.
Yeah. And I've been listening to some more electronic music lately. Over the past week, I've been really getting into Daedalus.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
You familiar with Daedalus? I remember his the collaborative album him and Kneebody did together like some years ago.
Yep.
And I thought it was cool at the time, but now I'm coming back to it and having like a different perspective on it, especially because I'm writing more of these beat oriented tracks and using samples for the first time. Right. So Daedalus has like a different meaning. It's I'm uncovering something about it that I didn't really understand years ago. And maybe it's I was just talking about songs kind of cutting right to the chase these days. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just a side effect of spending too much time like in the rock metal world. Because when I do listen to someone like Daedalus, there are tracks and there is live video of him just doing like almost like noise rock for 3 minutes before the beat kicks in. It's just like buzzes and twinkles and various filters folding on top of filters and stuff. And then all of a sudden the beat drops at some point. And then, you know, that's the payoff. But so it does exist. It definitely does exist. I guess I just haven't heard like stuff like that in the metal world for a while.
Yeah. I also think live, you can get away with different things than you could if it's like a studio recording. Yeah. Although it depends, man. I mean, when Tool dropped Fear Inoculum, I just remember like, I can't even finish this first song, man. Like I leave my house, I'm at the grocery store and it's only 7 minutes in and there's like another 2 minutes left or something. You know what I mean? Like every song on that record is like super long, you know?
Yeah.
So that was like for a while, I would measure like the distance in driving, like how many tracks through Fear Inoculum can I get through? And it's like 2.5, you know, it's like 20 minutes, like between here and like downtown LA or something. But I don't know. I get what you mean though. I think format can definitely influence how people choose to do their thing. But I also like people that are like, I don't care. This is what it is.
And I think that's probably the most important thing. Like if you are like confident and serve on a silver platter, whatever it is you're trying to come up with, I think that will pierce through a lot of stuff. Like, I don't know what it is, but when people see the subtlety in someone's face and body language and how they carry themselves and what they're doing, if the perception is that this person is doing what they're meant to be doing,
yeah,
then I think it's a hit.
I think that there's a weird thing that it's not, I don't know if I'd say it's a misnomer, but I would say, I think when you're performing, you have to consider the audience, right? Like you want to make sure, I mean, if it's the kind of thing that, if it's not like watching people play some stuff and like just they're in a moment and you're there to witness that moment. Like if you're at the Vanguard or, you know, the 55 bar RIP or like any place, any space where like musicians are improvising and you're just there to witness it. Then, you know, I'm not worried about seeing a light show or something like that. But if it's like a thing where, you know, you go to an arena, then you expect on some level, there's got to be some modicum of entertainment. But as far as anything else, like, I think most creative people, but especially musicians, I think people need to make stuff that they like themselves and not worry about what the audience thinks. Because I think most people who operate like that probably last a lot longer. And the quality of what they do, sure, there might be ebbs and flows, but it's probably more, I don't know, it's probably more of a hit than a miss with that ethos, you know? And I feel like a lot of people I've talked to, they kind of say in some version of this, like, well, if I like what I'm doing, then I have to assume other people might like it also. And I think that's a pretty, I know it sounds like very, very like earnest and stuff, but I think if there's a way to kind of stay the course and maybe like a way to self-correct it whenever you feel yourself being pulled by, because I think should is probably the most dangerous word in any language for an artist. Like, I should be doing this. Should I be doing this? or if you like talk to someone else, like, you know, sometimes like you have friends or peers you might talk to for advice. And like, it's not because you don't have an idea about what you're trying to do, but you want to just kind of hear what someone else might say when you talk about it. And then when someone throws, oh, you should be doing this, man. Like you told, like, man, I've heard you do this thing. You should totally be on that. And then that kind of plants a seed that maybe that seed's not supposed to grow in your, yeah, in your path, man. Like, and I think, you know, even if the intent for saying that is just to be an encouraging sentiment, like, hey, you know, like there's no reason why you couldn't play this if you wanted to, maybe that's a safer way to say it, but to say that you should. So I think like that kind of stuff can sometimes like have a weird effect on the purity of something. Cause I think a lot of times what makes things work really well in the end is like how pure they are. And people like that. People sense what that is. I do, you know?
Yeah. I know all about that. Like as soon as that seed is planted, like you ask someone genuinely for some advice and they give you some genuine feedback and they say something and you're like, right, I'm going to be as nice as possible. But like, oh yeah. Yeah. I'll think about that. And you're like, no. I think like anytime someone has said like, you should write some songs with like lyrics or like, you should try singing. Like, right. Like no. Yeah. Well, pretty much anything like my grandparents have said, like, hey, you ever think about playing like flamenco? Like, no.
Right.
It would be amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I would probably do it in my own. I can interpret that to like, I wonder like if I were inspired by some flamenco thing, what would I do with it? But like what they mean is, hey, stop what you're doing.
Right.
I go play flamenco at like the local flamenco dance studio because that's, you know, that's what real music is.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people kind of, they draw you into their experience of music and it's like, hey, you know, there's a band on The Voice. Why don't you go do that?
Oh yeah. That one too.
Professional karaoke.
Yeah.
I've definitely heard that before. Going to America's Got Talent.
Yeah. But brother. I think anything can be cool if it's something that someone wants to actually do. I think when it turns into something else, I think it gets confusing for people, you know, like I've been sort of at this place like where I'm working on new music.
Yeah. I want to hear more about what you're working on before we like run the clock on this.
Right now I'm mostly doing like a lot of remote sessions. I'm doing a lot of teaching. Like I teach like 20 hours a week. I play here and there. I'm trying to do more stuff. Cause you know, like there's definitely like a great community of musicians out here, but I'm feeling like creatively, I want to kind of like reset the clock a little bit. It's about time to make some new stuff and put it out there. Cause that's always kind of been a way for me to, I don't know, for some reason, like that's always been really good for like, when I get calls to play on other people's things, you know, but I'm trying to be a little more intentional about what I do. Like I'm in this really great spot right now where financially I'm all right. Like I'm doing pretty well. Like there's a lot of stability, but, it's like once you're not in a position where you have to hustle for like everything, you can breathe a little bit. I don't know. Like I've been thinking about like just things I've done, like, you know, I have a couple instruments that like I never use. And it's like, I think I bought this thinking I'd use this one day. Like one day I might need like a short scale, you know, kind of weird retro bass. And it's like, I never get called for stuff like that. I get called to play on like crazy stuff or like funk stuff. I'm kind of like musically kind of, it's like a dual citizen. It's either like funk stuff or like fusion and prog stuff, but I'm very happy with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the natural way of it. I feel like people will get targeted for being like a specialist.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing. You know, I don't want to get called for like, hey, can you do like the acoustic guitar strumming thing on this Christian record? Like you can find someone else for that. I'm not interested. Yeah. unless you're going to really like throw the wallet at me.
So there is a number.
Yeah. There's always a number. This is a hot take. I'm going to preface this by saying this is just my opinion. I think I felt like I was sold a bill of goods in music school when people were saying, don't be a specialist. I think the greatest thing people can be in some cases is a specialist. Maybe have a wide range of skills, you know, be able to read lead sheets and read written music and like maybe understand a few styles. But people are always going to be called for the thing that they do the best. And I think if the thing that you do the best is pliable enough, that might be where the illusion of versatility comes in. But I think, like, by and large, most people I know who are really great, they're great at like a thing that can be stretched a few different ways. Cause then it becomes like the jack of all trades, master of none. I never wanted to be one of those musicians that could play everything but sounded like nothing. You know, I always wanted to sound like have an identity.
That's how you get the wedding band gigs.
Yeah. Those are just kind of a means to an end. You know, like I stumbled into the one I was in for a couple of years just because my friend ran sound and played trumpet. And literally he was like, dude, we're doing the showcase at the Copley Square Hotel, this hotel behind Berkeley. Just come play a tune. They need a bass player. I was like, all right. So I sat in. I think I had gone to get like dinner somewhere. I just walked through this mall into this hotel, played Sex Machine in this lobby. And they're like, hey, you want to play gigs with us? I'm like, yeah, cool. And it was like, so it was just kind of easy. But
beer money.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where there's a discipline and a thing you can get from that. But you don't need to do that kind of stuff for years to obtain it. There's a dude out here named Ruslan Sirota. He's like this great keyboard player. And he plays like a lot of jazz stuff. And he was using those gigs to learn how to play two boards and get into utility stuff. Like, how do I get my horn sounds? How do I get like my string sounds? And, you know, like, I think for a while he wanted to do pop stuff. So he did. And then he's not really doing that so much now. But, you know, you can treat that stuff as a way to force yourself into stuff you wouldn't otherwise do yourself.
Yeah. Well, I like that advice, though. Hey, it turns out it might actually be good after all to be a specialist, to be the guy
that's
really good at this thing. I mean, the artists that I listen to and like the stuff that I'm really putting on now, I'm listening to because I don't hear anyone else doing stuff like that. Like now I've got Wayne Krantz in rotation, Basic Live 06.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no way I'm going to find a guitar player or a trio that sounds like what they're playing on that record. And it's amazing. Like when I really want to hear that kind of playing, that's what I go to. Before that, I was listening to Matheny's Bright Size Life. I mean, that's 1976. That sound has been copied so hard, but like, that's like the OG.
You ever hear the live versions of those songs?
No, I don't think so.
I got bootlegs of some of that stuff, man. I think it came from a cassette, so it's a little bit faster, but it's out there, man. You can hear like the three of them. And it's cool because they're not nailing all the shit. Like there's clams. There's clams and they fuck some things up. But yeah, it's cool to hear them play that stuff in a live setting. Cause it's amazing. Did you ever read the book about like the Bill Mikowski book about Jaco? He wrote like a biography. Bob Moses talks about that trio. Weirdly enough, in the Jaco documentary, they don't really spend a lot of time on Bright Side's Life because I don't think Matheny wanted to be in the, he wasn't in the movie, but they kind of like address it, but then they kind of move on. But Bob Moses kind of was comparing the live version of that trio with Jaco and Pat. He said it was kind of like the Band of Gypsies or Cream or something. You know, this is the 70s, so those are his reference points. But he's like, it was kind of a rocking thing in some ways. It wasn't as precious as it sounded on the ECM thing.
What's he saying? He's saying that like if you were to see them live, it was a little bit grainier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that actually came across a little bit in the recording. Like there's even some clams here and there on the recording. And like, you know, maybe Jaco didn't totally like learn the part until like an hour before he had to record it or something like that. And then they just kind of make some shit up instead. And
yeah,
you know, you could tell. That's cool though. I like that stuff. I've been following you since like the Stimpy Lockshot days. So I'm always curious, like what you got going on and what you're up to. And you've like managed to play with some pretty cool people. Like, I mean, I was a fan of Fuzhinsky like back in college. And then I didn't find out that you played with him until you and I had met. I was like, oh shit, that's pretty cool. And then I saw you playing with McAlpine. And I was like, oh my God, I used to. So it's always been like a funny thing that like you've like always kind of ended up playing with some guitar player that I've at some point like.
Yeah. Like I wish the McAlpine thing had gone differently. That was supposed to be an 8-week tour and It was only a couple weeks, but that guy's a fantastic musician. Nice dude. Amel was awesome too, man. I mean, it was kind of like playing, that gig was like playing with two guitar players. But yeah, dude, there's been a lot of guitar players, man. Just like Fusinski. I jammed with Krantz a few times. That almost happened, but I got busy, so it never turned into anything. But we're friends and stuff. Like we were doing some playing like underneath like where Katz's is.
The deli?
Yeah, the deli. There's like a little rehearsal spot he used to have over there sometimes.
Oh, funny. I didn't know that.
I had just gotten to the end of my time playing with Fuse, and I was starting to feel like, I don't know, like maybe I don't need to play with all my heroes. Just because I'd done some of that, and I think, you know, I think I was very enamored with like the Miles Davis book where, you know, he went to seek out playing with Charlie Parker, and this idea of like trying to play with someone to somehow like get, maybe not validation, but you know, you're trying to go to the source of what inspires you. So if you can work with someone that does that or learn from them, I learned a ton from playing with Fuse, you know, and it wasn't always the easiest lessons, you know, but in terms of artistry, and the one cool thing about him is like no one sounds like him. So
I mean, there's that again. Yeah, you like Dave Fuzinski sounds like Dave Fuzinski. That's something I'm struggling with right now, but I think that's the next chapter in my playing, to figure that out. Like I know I'm close, but I haven't quite gotten there yet.
That's how you hear it though, right? Because you're inside of it. But I mean, what I like about your playing is that, you know, you tick a lot of the boxes that I like about guitar. You know, like you have a sound, you got the aggressive thing, you write cool riffs, and the rhythms are really insane. Like there's definitely like jazz vocabulary in there, and there's like, you know, I can tell you definitely like some of the guitar players, but you don't really sound like them either.
That's good to know.
Yeah. I'm sure we could rattle off the names of like five players that kind of bit off the Holdsworth tree, right? And that, and how would that not be the case? Because like, what an astounding player that guy was. But like,
that's a hard thing not to bite off of.
That was my gateway to Meshuggah. Like, I think the first Meshuggah record I heard was None or something. Like, it was right before Destroyer, Race and Proof.
Yeah, they're vague Metallica vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could tell from the lead playing, I was like, oh, I bet this dude likes Holdsworth, you know? And like the first time I saw them play was like 1998, and like Frederick had a breath controller. So it was kind of, you know, it was kind of an interesting period for that band, you know? And they were on this really interesting bill. It was like Slayer was the headliner, and it was like, I think Meshuggah, Sick of It All, and maybe some other band. But they did their thing, man, like to an audience that was probably not really ready for it.
It took some time. I think no one was really ready for it until Absent, I think. And then it kind of popped off, but maybe someone can challenge me on that. But that's the vibe I got. Man, Holdsworth was born in 1946.
Yep.
That's fucking crazy. Like who picks up guitar in 19, I don't know when he started playing. He started playing as a teenager, I think I've heard before, but shit, that still puts him in like 1960.
Right.
And then you start playing guitar like that. It's so fucking weird. Yeah, but then Thordendahl's Special Defects, that album is totally gnarly. I put that on like once a year.
That's a great record.
And I'm just like, oh, God damn, this is fucking cool. I would still love to have a chat with him one day, and Matthias Eklund, right? Matthias Ia Eklund, and just ask them about how they produce some of those guitar tones. Because I'm like, wait, is that a synth? Is that a, like Jesse Zaretti? You familiar with Jesse Zaretti?
I think I know the name.
He's doing a lot of game composition stuff now, but he was like in the, like my New York, Jersey area, like playing with Everforth, right? His band back in the day. But yeah, so we kind of went through the metal stuff together at some point. And I've even sent him the stuff because he's super, super involved in like production and gaming music these days. I was like, how the hell did he make this? And even he was like, I think it's like a synth or maybe a MIDI thing. But given that it's 1990, whatever, 1998, 1996, like, yeah. I can't be sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm still looking for that thing that's like going to really be like, oh, like, yeah, Nick had his prog stuff. He does his fusion stuff. But then he did this then he figured it out. Like then he did this other thing. And I think I'm kind of getting closer to that with this like sampling stuff that I'm doing. Like I'm starting to look into drum machines and samplers and looping stuff. And if I could figure out a way to incorporate that into my sound, I think that'd be pretty cool. And I started off as a drummer and I, you know, like writing all the ever forthright music. Clearly I'm very influenced by rhythm.
Yeah.
So it'd be kind of cool to incorporate some kind of drum machine, looper, sampler type stuff into my sound. It'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I got into samplers in the last couple of years.
Oh yeah. I got to ask you about it then. Cause I'm like, wait, is what I want a drum machine, or is it a drum machine that has a sampler, or is it just a sampler, or do I want a looper? Or do I want all those things? I don't know. It seems like, and there's so many of them. There's like,
yeah.
Jesus, if you like Google like the best looper or best sampler, it's like 23 of the best loopers that came out in 2023. And they're all right. Like, you know, $700 to $1,200.
Yeah. I think the thing that's interesting right now is that what you can do inside the box is pretty significant. And I think if you have a certain kind of workflow, because I have a couple tactile samplers. I got an SP 404 Mark II. Doesn't quite do what an MPC does, but it rose to prominence because Jay Dilla used an SP when he made donuts when he was like kind of like sick in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Like he used that in a turntable. And Madlib also is famous for using like the SP 303. The big thing about the SP 303 that was sort of the landmark, I guess, component that gave it some of its sauce, we'll call it that, they had like these built-in effects. So there was like a vinyl sim effect that sounded really cool. And a lot of the lo-fi stuff, grainy, you know, kind of warbly vinyl thing. And that was probably popularized just from like those machines. Mm-hmm. But I think what I've found is like, I mostly work in Logic. And Logic has some good sampler. They have a couple built-in samplers that work pretty well. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting frontier to move away from your principal instrument, but not to another instrument that is similar, right? Like you pick something where you're not playing strings or frets, but it's not percussion either. It's like a box with buttons and you're dealing with like waveforms and you can chop it up and you can process things. I think there is a really interesting thing you can gain from that. I just love it because a lot of the music I like listening to has components of that in there, you know? So it's kind of like, how do they do this? You know, especially like a lot of those drum and bass records. It's like, how do they make it sound like this?
Yeah. One thing I'm trying to think about is like this new track I put out today, you know, I could very easily just take the guitar out, plug it into a backing track and have Jared drum along with it to a click. And like the song will always be 2 minutes and 20 seconds or however long. If I want to make the song 3 minutes, it'll always be 3 minutes live.
Yeah.
But how do I make it a little bit more organic? Like, do I just take those samples and plug them into some pads and actually play the beat myself and then loop it? Is that like the most authentic way to do it? Or like maybe I have the loop pre-programmed and I press play on the loop. And then I cue the next loop. I mean, all these things are possible. I guess it's up to me to define how exactly I want to do it.
Ableton Live is probably still one of the most useful things if you're going to get into like incorporating that kind of stuff into like a playing live scenario. You know, who's really great with that stuff is Matt Garrison. Matt's one of my favorite bass players and he's a good dude, but he'd always be working in Ableton and he'd have his bass and he'd like play through things, but you know, he was using like controllers on the floor. He's really good at that stuff. But yeah, I feel like a lot of like production oriented live things use Ableton just because it's not hard to like cue tracks and stuff like that. But there is an interactive way to work with it. I think it involves using some element of controllerism. So you have some kind of a thing where you can trigger things, but you can also manipulate the things. I don't know, man. It's pretty cool. There's definitely definitely a lot
frontier.
Yeah,
I think that's the next frontier. I can either sit down and like get better at rhythm changes, or I can like try to experiment with something like brand new. And I think my heart is telling me to try something brand new.
Yeah. I think there's room for both. You know, I don't know if you should combine both, but I'm not saying you shouldn't combine both, but like, cause I, you know, remember when everyone was trying to like combine jazz and like electronic stuff and to varying degrees, you know, like it was sort of a thing. It's like, or it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to play jazz versions of Radiohead songs.
Snoresville. I mean, it's been done pretty cool a couple times. Like Bad Plus is Nirvana. Yeah.
Yep.
That's pretty rad. Yes. It's a couple times, but a lot of the time it comes off cliche. I don't think I've ever heard a good version of metal and jazz coming to like together that isn't just like painful.
Yeah.
Except for, you know, the stuff that I've written, but
right.
Of course. I wanted to ask you one more thing before wrapping this up.
Sure.
So at the time of recording Stimpy, I think we were talking about possibly playing some shows with Animals as Leaders before Stimpy Lockjaw had ever had a rehearsal. Am I making that up, or was that something that was like probably on the table back in the day?
It was on the table because I'm pretty tight with Javier. I know the other guys too, but I think I was like, hey man, check out this thing I played on. And they were trying to, I think they were doing a tour with Devin Townsend. So it would have been like, if you guys were like, all right, we're trying to break the band. Like we're trying to like bring this music to the people who like this kind of stuff. I think it would have been a really cool thing to do, but I think it was definitely going to be a, like so many things where you start out, like the tour would have probably wouldn't have made any money. It would have been maybe operating at a loss.
Yeah. We already had no money. I had,
right.
I had just quit my job at Barnes & Noble for $8 an hour. There was no way I was going to be able to afford to go on tour.
Yeah, dude, that's a tough call, man.
I don't even know where we would have gotten the money from. I mean, even to like the handful of times that we went to Astoria Soundworks to rehearse was like, shit, I don't have $20. Like, and to this day, it's hard to pull the money together to even record something like that. The metal EP I sent you, the Noah EP, you know, that's a few grand, and
right,
I didn't make a few grand back when I sold it. Like I had to rent a studio and pay people.
Yeah.
I'm essentially donating music. It's a music philanthropist.
Yeah. I think sometimes that stuff, you won't know what you're going to get back from it until much later. But I think if you're going to go out on the road for, I don't remember how long that shit was going to be, maybe like 20 plus days. And it's like you got to rent a van, you got to cart your own gear and do all the things. And mind you, I've never toured like that. Like I should say, like I've done some get in the van type stuff, but mostly it's been fairly cush. And I kind of feel guilty saying that, but like when you're just like a hired gun, like, you know, there's a certain level where it's like everyone gets their own hotel room and it's like, it's not that hard to move around. But, you know, there's been times like even with Fusinski, like he had a van, like we'd do some stuff in the Northeast where we just would get in a van and that was fine. But I mean, like for a month, you know, like I've never done that.
Yeah. We did that with Everforthright a couple of times. It's hard. It's really, really hard.
Yeah. Even when I don't want to go into this too much because I don't want to speak out of school, but like, I think my sense when the McAlpine thing went weird, I feel like Emil was used to the metal world, so some of it was not that jarring for him. But I think like for me and like maybe other guys in the band, it was like, what the hell is this?
Like, wait, where are we showering tonight?
So here's what happened. Like there is a photo that got posted the day this happened, like where it's like everyone's gear at a truck stop in Joliet, Illinois. And what happened was the bus driver woke us up that morning. It was like February 14th, 2019 or 15th. I remember the day, man. And he just was like,
in Chicago?
I haven't gotten paid. Like right outside Chicago. Like, you know, in Blues Brothers, there's that prison in Joliet. It was like right around there. Essentially, like the bus driver said, I haven't gotten paid and I can't take you any further. And so he kind of waited for us to figure out what we were going to do. there we were, like all the gear. It was a giant mess, man.
Fuck.
And I'm not going to pull any punches, but I'm also going to say I don't believe that whoever may have been responsible for us being in that predicament, I'm sure they didn't want that to go that way. I think it was like, but it just wasn't, it was a really strange experience.
It's interesting that still happens at a certain level. Like I'm friends with, he's a road tech for a professional guitarist, pretty popular, well-known guitarist, goes on the road with them, pretty much sets up all his stuff, drives the van. You know, he's the road guy,
right?
Does their sound. And like the horror stories this guy tells me, it's like the mistreatment of people and equipment and mishandling of money. It just makes me, I'm just amazed at how someone could have a career of 30, 40 years. And like, this is the way that it's still operating. I mean, the world's still going to go around. The sun still comes up tomorrow. Yeah. You know, knock on wood.
Yeah.
Unless shit really hits the fan, no one's going to stop someone from running an operation that's like half-assed. But it's so interesting to me, especially because I've become so organized in my adult, like, I guess in my adult life. Like there was a time in my 20s when I was just completely disorganized. Didn't care if I had money or not. Didn't have money or didn't care if I was in, you know, like if my student loans were in collections, in forbearance or not. Like if my credit score was 400 or whatever, I didn't give a shit. And now so many years later, that stuff is really important to me. So yeah, I don't know. It makes me wonder if I'd make a great like tour manager. Just keep everyone. I'd be such a dad.
I mean, you basically did that forever forthright.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I was the grumpy dad the entire time, all the time.
You made sure everything was working well. And it did because you did.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Someone's got to do it. you know, I think that's the thing that's really interesting though, is like, that particular situation I talked about, like, I don't believe there's any bad intent on anyone's part. Like it wasn't like, no one was trying to like screw anybody out of money. It just sort of went bad. And like, so I'm not trying to demonize anybody involved. Like that much I can say, like, there's no bad person in it, but like, that doesn't mean that like stuff still can't go wrong, you know? So like, I'm not mad at anybody. And I think highly of everyone, you know, that was involved with that and people, but it was interesting to kind of just see like some people's touring experiences, like are more informed by stuff like that. And in my case, it was less so. You know, like there's been like other stuff where it's like unforeseen things that happen. But like by and large, like, I don't know, man, it made for a good story. It was a little bit interesting for a while. I was mad about it for a long time.
There's a concept of boiling the frog. I don't know. Have you heard of that? Like to boil the frog? Yeah. Yep. Like you got to be really careful of small problems that compound. Like it's like, oh, okay, we owe the driver $10. Like I'll pay him tomorrow. All right. Shit. We owe this guy and that guy $30 a piece now. Like, all right, I'll have to take care of that tomorrow. And then like the more and more you put these little problems aside, the sooner or later, you're going to be, you're going to be boiling and you kind of don't even realize how you got there. You know, that could definitely happen too. And that can happen to the nicest of people.
Yeah.
There very well could be no malintent, but that frog could be boiling before you know it.
Yeah. I mean, but I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, there's probably people who they mean well and their intentions were good. And, you know, sometimes stuff doesn't quite land the way it's supposed to land. You know, that was definitely one of those experiences where I came away from it questioning a lot.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. I'm trying to book a couple of shows that may require spending the night in somewhere. Like if I can get like a week of back-to-back shows, that'd be pretty cool. And but lately I'm only playing with a drummer. Me and Jared are just playing together. So that's a lot easier to manage than a whole bus of people. Anything coming up that I can know about? Anyone else can know about?
Nothing really crazy on the horizon, man. I mean, I'm going to be kind of, you know, I mean, I guess my Instagram, I'm always posting stuff there. Lately I haven't been, but I'll be back. I'm kind of working on some new music. But yeah, nothing. I have nothing to plug right now. Teaching.
Yeah.
Doing some writing stuff. Working on, like, I guess, album number 3. But I don't really know what that means, because it might be like a few singles and then a bunch of other tracks.
Yeah. Well, check out Waterfall Release Strategy if you haven't gone down that rabbit hole yet. Yeah. Just YouTube it. You'll learn a little bit about, like, one of the most efficient ways to release stuff on, like, streaming services nowadays. It's kind of the best of both worlds, like single releases and album releases all kind of boiled in one. Waterfall release.
Okay, cool, man.
All right, I'll catch you later.
Yeah, thanks for having me.